Welcome to Lost River Legends. Our motto, Ex Tenebris, is Latin for out of the shadows. We attempt to understand the complex world around us and bring light to subjects hidden in darkness. We explore paranormal topics with guests from all around the world. Now welcome your Lost River Legends hosts, James and Brett. We hope you enjoy the show.
The latest episode of Lost River Legends. Thank you for listening. In this second of a two-part episode, we continue our conversation with Troy McLaughlin about the Saturn death cult. And in this conversation, he surmises that this ancient cult is obsessed with human enslavement and they enrich themselves with money and world power. He also believes that they are obsessed with human ritualistic sacrifice and death, especially among children. Listeners should be aware that this episode contains content and themes that may be disturbing in nature. Listener discretion is advised. We appreciate you finding and listening to the show. We encourage you to give us a 5-star review and feel free to share your favorite episode on social media. And remember, you can find us on Instagram and on Facebook. And with that out of the way, here is the latest episode with Troy McLaughlin. Enjoy the show.
Right, ladies and gentlemen, I say that binarily, but anyway, we're very pleased to be joined again today by Troy McLaughlin, and he joins us from England. We've had a little bit of an exchange here where we're trying to figure out how to go about this subject. Just kind of a forewarning ahead of time that it's very much an adult subject. We want to make sure that we cover this, and it actually we've set the table for this subject of the Saturnian death. What are the implications of that? It's an ancient system, and how is it being applied now? Welcome to the show, Troy. How are you doing today?
I'm doing very well. Thank you for having me once again.
You know, the pleasure is all ours. We've been fed generously from our last visit, so much so that we were like, okay, we got to have you back on to cover this other subject that's actually very important. Would you like to try to introduce us to the idea of the Saturnian death cult? What does that mean? How did you kind of come up with that name? And what's kind of the thrust of your work there?
Well, a death cult is officially defined as and this is a quote, a fringe group that glorifies or is obsessed with death. What I've done in my book, Saturn Death Cult, is I take that definition further and I identify it with any group or agenda that requires the pre-planned sacrifice and exploitation, even up to murder itself, of others so that a particular group can achieve its aims and objectives. You know, the existence of what I call a Saturn death cult is fundamentally tied to the specific existence and worship of an ancient creator god archetype, the Saturn archetype. And this is an archetype. This is a god who is known to be a capricious god, yet highly authoritative in terms of his archetype. And is capable of being used to express both good and evil. And it is one that is found in the collective consciousness of just about all major cultures and peoples throughout the world. However, it is the manipulation of that archetype and the perceived creative force that can be supposedly achieved by various forms of ritual sacrifice. And it's often crimes committed during these rituals that help certain elites gain control over their socioeconomic and political structures, those structures that govern us. The control is facilitated by the blackmailable material generated by these ritualistic crimes. They include sex crimes such as pedophilia and murder. And this is basically what the Satan Death Cult is about. It's more about a culture of murder rather than a, you know, a card-carrying club of, you know, satanic cannibals that meets in some undesignated underground social venue. However, I'm pretty much convinced that some of the political and economic elites in the world today are, to a variable degree, involved in promoting this kind of behavior. The key is that a culture that is based around Saturn will inevitably promote the idea of a small group, an elite minority, wanting to exploit a larger group of people for their own personal benefit at the expense of that larger group of people.
So in that, parenthetically, they basically have learned this from ancient times. This is not something new. It's not something that has emerged in the current era. It's something that goes way back. And I'd like to get to some of the origins of that, as far as how that came about.
Well, what it's based upon is, as we discussed in our previous discussion, the Saturn archetype is directly related to what happened with the planet Saturn and its relationship to Earth. And when the Earth in tow to Saturn was captured by the solar system, as we discussed before, Saturn underwent drastic physical changes. Many of these changes totally transformed the environment on the Earth, as you know, as it was then known. It was transformed from a very dark, dusky place into a place bathed in a brilliant light. And what effectively happened was that humanity discovered the concept of calculating the passage of time. And this was attributed to this bursting forth of light from Saturn. We, in the Saturn Death Cult, I, of course, identified this as being a brown dwarf star that was electrically overloaded when it came into contact with the sun's electrical field. And as a result of that overload, it did a sort of a super, like a nova-like explosion. Not a supernova, but it went into a nova-like explosion. And that correlates in mythology with, you know, the famous phrase in the Bible, "Let there be light." The fact that Saturn brought forth light, or those gods that are associated with the Saturn archetype in other cultures, that god is always associated with bringing forth light, and as a result of that, the ability to calculate time. And that was largely a result of the loss of a cocooning plasmasphere around the Earth that had shielded the Earth from the greater cosmos. That was neutralized electrically, allowing people on the planet to see the greater cosmos and be able to use what they saw to calculate time in terms of how the celestial bodies started to move. And this was Saturn's great gift. And as a result of that, we're told in mythology that humanity entered into this wonderful golden age where the whole basis of weights and measures, of which the calculation of time is the first of that concept, but weights and measures is the means by which humanity starts to develop civilization. It's the basis of civilization. And it was all attributed to this event. When Saturn was knocked from its position much later in an event called Doomsday, according to mythology, and which we posit was the eventual capture of the Saturnian system, which was Earth, Mars, the newly born planet Venus, and Saturn itself, was eventually rearranged into, would eventually become what we see today in the skies with Saturn on the outskirts of the solar system, the Earth, where it is in relation to Mars and Venus. When that doomsday event took place, much of the concept of weights and measures being a source of a golden age, a time of discovery and so on, was compromised by the sudden change of environment, which led to an unheard of concept called scarcity of resources. And as a result of the scarcity of resources, humans had to organize, and the key to that organization was to try and retain what had been, effectively just been there as part of the Golden Age, which was the systems of weights and measures, so that groups of people could develop societies that could exploit the environment in such a way that they could be profitable from it without succumbing to the scarcity which the seasonal changes that had been introduced by doomsday had brought, upon the earth. What you have as a result of that is a society that is now very dependent on people's interpretation of what those weights and measures were during the Golden Age. And so subsequently, people looked to people who had knowledge of what Saturn was, that great time before doomsday. You've got to put it in the context of people surviving a cataclysm where you've got refugees from a grand civilization where they've lost everything, and now they've got to rebuild those connections with those previous golden times. And as a result of that, people with a knowledge of Saturn, people with a knowledge of weights and measures, became very important to the way society was structured. I called this the Silver Age, where the priesthoods were established. But with the priesthoods came the inevitable desire on the part of individuals to use Saturnian knowledge to their own benefit at the expense of others, in such a way that they could monopolize the scarcity of resources under their own control, and ensure that they and whoever is with them benefit more so than other people. So effectively, you have conflict introduced as a result of doomsday in the battle over scarce resources, and the people who are leading those conflicts are the people who have been looked to try and reestablish the golden age of justice and equal weights measures. But that gets eroded with corruption and the fact that you do have a scarcity problem in the wake of the doomsday event.
So I think about the weights and measures just kind of basically at a basic level. It's like so much of this for a bushel of wheat. So much of this for, whatever other product, and that's kind of how at a base level those things worked. And then over time built to perhaps be, metals or something that held value in their eyes. But going from one age to another age, I mean, in between there is a massive loss of life. So those that remain were able to apply their knowledge from the previous age to the other age and withhold perhaps some of the knowledge for themselves and not share. So it's kind of almost like a selfish motivation to begin with.
Yes, it is. And as we discussed in our last interview, the a key part of biblical wisdom that comes into this is a statement that God tells Adam after the fall: by the sweat of your brow will you make the earth yield its fruits. And this is reflected in many other different cultures, the same sort of concept. So what you have here is the having to organize to make that the earth yield its fruits. That becomes central to any society's ability to function and thrive, because they have to engage in this kind of work. And you do get people who would rather not work and would rather have other people do the work, but it's not easy for such people to just simply get out. You know, other people might, you know, do it out of charity for somebody for a while, but at some point the majority of us are going to say you've got to pull your own weight. It just tends to be that way. So what you need is a mechanism by which you can convince people to work for you on the basis that they feel that you have the authority to institute such a system where they work and you reap the benefits of that. Now, the key to that is that, as we discussed, Saturn brought about the measure, which is the calculation of time. And we have other measures which have dealt with distance and volume and weight and so on like that. And they all go into being able to trade with people, being able to communicate ideas with people as to what you want and what needs to be achieved. But the second greatest measure that comes out of all of this is the measure of the price for work done. All right. And this is a concept that is not taught, and I believe I believe that this is something that is deliberate in that it's not taught when it comes to teaching people about what money is. And we are often told, most of us grow up believing that money is a means of exchange, all right? That money is, a fungible way of exchanging value. This is really only half the equation as far as the concept of what money is, because the true definition of money is that it is a measure of work done. And if you control that measure, in other words, a dollar represents a level of work done. So if I make a chocolate bar and I say it's worth $1, all right, then that measures the work I've done to make that chocolate bar, and you have to give me that dollar in order to take that chocolate bar off me. That's how money functions. It measures my work done. And if you give the power to people to define arbitrarily that measure in such a way that they can, they can use that to benefit themselves without having to do work. In other words, to create that measure, to give them that power to buy other people's work, and everybody accepts that, you have a tremendously dangerous form of power that is associated with that measure. And so, when we talk about money being a measure for work done, the basic principle is that in terms of the con for these people who are trying to monopolize work done and the resources that are used up in doing that for themselves, the idea is very simple, so simple that none of us would accept it if it was put this way. And that is, if I give you 10 of something, all right, 10 units of, $10, on 10 bits of separate paper, and these are the only bits of paper on the planet that represent those $10. And I say to you, you can take that in and trade amongst yourselves using that. But at the end of the year, I want $11 back. You've just asked that person to do something impossible. You've gone beyond the measure of it, and you've asked them to get an 11th dollar that doesn't exist. If you then say, if you cannot come up with that 11th dollar, I get to own all your stuff, everything that you've made, no one would fall for it. It's just too obvious. It's just too stupid an idea for people to accept as a way of somebody, producing a measure. The measure becomes false. everybody can see that it's false. It doesn't it doesn't measure work at all. It's a false measure. But and of course that's what we call interest or usury, where you add an imaginary something onto an existing measure of what money is in an economic system. They, of course, introduce all kinds of systems where they say, don't worry about the 11th dollar, we'll lend it to you. But when it comes back to it, when you bring that extra dollar that we've lent to you, I want $1.10, all right? And this is where national debt builds up, and this is where the debt of nations, of groups of people, even individuals and so on, becomes such a burden that at the end of the day, people end up losing their liberty. They end up losing what they work for. And this is why usury was always, and all the major religions are in agreement with it, it is always one of the great prohibitions of the major religions, that nobody engages in that. We live in a world today where usury is just simply identified as excessive interest. But interest is usury. It doesn't matter if it's 0.001%. If that 0.01% of interest is called and is accepted as a claim on somebody's work, if they can't pay it back, then somebody is always going to lose out because it doesn't actually exist in what has been issued. So the moral of the story is that if you want to be able to make a claim on everybody's work, on everybody's productive capacity, introduce a system where you give 10 of something and you ask for 11 of those things back, even though there isn't that 11th something there to be given back. And do it in such a way that people will accept the idea that it is a debt that must be repaid, and if it can't be repaid, you forfeit what you've worked for over a period of time. So you can see how time as a measure is intricately linked into money as a measure. Both work hand in hand. And this was the great corruption of weights and measures that took place after the Golden Age and led to the establishment of a series of cataclysms that the story, the Tower of Babel or Babel, however you want to pronounce it, alludes to.
So with that, comes a almost a robbing of people's free will to a certain extent, and you know most people would see that pretty violent of violation of God's law or of God's will for people.
The biblical concept is you shall have no diverse weights or measures. All right, this is a hard and fast rule that you find in the Bible. And if we accept that money is a measure and not just simply a means of exchange, which is what we're taught in the schools, if we accept that it is a measure, then the whole idea of usury means that no matter how much an economy and the people in the economy works through a given period of time, at the end of that time, somebody is going to lose. It's just a given. Somebody is going to be foreclosed on. And it always starts with a small percentage of people that fail as a result of the calling in of debts and so on like that. And what that does is, people accept the idea that, they're just lazy. It's people who are indolent. It's people who were fools with their money or such and such. I was able to pay my part back. Why couldn't they? But this is an impossibility this is an absolute impossibility under a usury system. The cleverness and the insidiousness of the whole usury system is that it is used over a period of time to build that debt over a group of people so that while the amount of people that fail and become foreclosed on, and that property somehow goes into whoever it is has been designated the power to issue this measure of work done, this thing called money. But as that debt accumulates over a period of time, you get this phenomenon that you've got a small group of people who start to come into possession and make claims on entire nations, entire peoples. And this must be one of the most evil concepts that has ever stalked this planet.
I agree, and I think it's something that takes perspective, like what you've just done, and breaking it down to the most basic level, and understanding, you know, some of these sayings that we have, like time is money, or you know, if you work hard enough, you can buy anything, or there's that whole, you know, you can buy anything with money, you can buy, but you can't buy happiness, things like that.
Yeah.
There's a lot of kind of quips that have come along through the years. Yeah. But it's interesting.
I'll just add in there, if you want the drop the mic moment in terms of these sayings, it is the root of all evil is the love of money. All right? That's a biblical saying that puts it in perspective. Why do people have a love of money? Because money gives them control, but it also gives them the ability to survive when other people are not surviving in a scarce world. All right? That's what the usury system does in building conflict. Take away the usury system, I think a lot of our social problems disappear overnight if you have an equitable monetary system that is not based on interest. It's crucial to understand that the love of money is the root of all evil. It's not Satan is the root of all evil, or the devil is the root of all evil, or even Saturn worship is the root of all evil or anything. It's the love of money. What Saturn worship has done is it has provided some, malicious type people down through the centuries with archetypes that can be used in the form of symbolism and such to manipulate whole swathes of people into accepting a disastrous and a very destructive measure, a form of money that is it's a false measure of work done. And, it leaves in every society that adopts any form of interest-based money issuance, it always ends up with a growing number of people who are losers, no matter how hard they work, no matter how much they go out and sweat in the fields to make the earth yield its fruits. They always end up losing. And it usually takes about 70 years. Sometimes it lasts 100 years. But every 70 years or so, they've got to reset the system in some way or another. And the carnage and it's usually done through a war or some mass killing event, whether it's disease or whatever brought about by malnutrition from financial destitution, or, you know, all these sorts of things that can happen as a result of this usury system. You know, in Saturn Death Cult, I identify the financial usury systems that have been instituted down through the centuries as Mystery Babylon. It's a form, you know, Babylon is that system identified in the Bible that is adverse to God's system of financial equity, where you have equal weights and measures. And the Babylonian system has been instituted so many times in various forms down through the centuries that it's my belief that the Book of Revelation is very clear in laying at its feet the blood of virtually all those who have died, as a result of violence, war, and deprivation, down through the centuries.
So, Troy, excuse me, I have a question. I mean, you're talking about this reset, you know, every 70 years, whether it's mm-hmm. it's in war or other means, and I don't want to get into the weeds with my question here, but we're in the midst of kind of the coronavirus right now, and we're seeing a huge influx of right now, at least in India and Japan, there's these waves of deaths right now, but globally there's a lot of people that have passed away, and we're seeing economies. And here in the U.S., you know, there's been a lot of bailouts and economic pushes mm-hmm. by our government giving handouts. And again, I don't want to get into the weeds, but what's your take, you know, whole cloth here throughout the world? What's your take on what's going on financially with the greater picture that you're talking about?
Well, of course, the certain difficult book that I wrote identifies this whole concept of there being two golden ages, the one in the past that was wonderful under Saturn before it was destroyed by a doomsday event, and the symmetrical idea that you get in esoteric and occult traditions, which is that there is another golden age to be had, but it will be triggered by a similar doomsday event. These guys, you know, what I call the Saturn Death Cult, have been working towards triggering that event to bring about a new golden age where you get a jump in evolution and the heirs to the Saturn legacy take control of the planet and they run it according to their desires and so on. This is what I argue in the book is the overall idea of, so history as a giant ritual in terms of what these people are trying to achieve. At the more immediate level, what I believe is going on, and I believe it is not working out very well for them, is that they have actually tried. They had a plan to trigger a new doomsday event. It was going to be a nuclear conflict, ostensibly kicked off between the United States and Russia, if they could do it. It was going to leave China, the sole superpower, able to bring about a new society on Earth. And it was going to be a double whammy, much in the way that the playbook was run in the First World War, where you had a massive meat-grinding total war experience, the true first of its kind on a global scale, that killed millions of men, followed by a pandemic, very, very similar. In fact, it's virtually the same. It's a form of flu, what was called the Spanish flu. Some people say 18 million, some people say up to 100 million dead. Nobody really knows. And coupled in with that, an age of revolution. And in that case, they overthrew the Tsar, and effectively European royalty lost its true place in terms of the greater scheme of things when it comes to who is running the show. I believe they've tried to do the same thing in terms of starting a war, which hasn't actually happened. Now, they probably are still trying at this stage. A virus, and I'm going out on a limb here, a virus was introduced, and this gain-of-function stuff that people are talking about, I think, that's all starting to break now that this was a man-made virus of some kind that was introduced to do a job. And there was going to be a revolution, but instead of Tsarist Russia, it was going to be the republic that we know to be the United States of America. And the United States of America was going to be overthrown in exactly the same format, the same way that the Bolsheviks under the the Mensheviks in the Russian Revolution of 1917, where you know, a small group of people were able to take bureaucratic control over a government and then institute a socialist state socialism on the people. In the United States, you've got two factions that have always been at odds with each other: corporate fascism and the idea of bureaucratic socialism or state socialism. And really, that's all that was needed to be sorted out. Who was really going to end up running the show between those two types of groups? But I've got great faith that, in fact, the whole thing has failed. And I put that down, actually, to the strength of the American people and its... and its spiritual legacy. In Saturn Death Cult, I go into great detail just how significant the American Revolution was when they broke away from the European financial system, because that's what it was. Everybody thinks it's political and such, but the big thing about the American Revolution was it was the taxes that were being used to pay the debts to the British central banking system. And that's what the founding fathers of the United States broke away from in a tax revolt. And it took the powers that be nearly 100 years to gain control over the people of America, which they did when they instituted the Federal Reserve in 1913. And it's pretty much all been downhill since that time. But they've overplayed their hand. And I think that has a lot to do with inbreeding within the elites that have, you know, been involved in these plans down through the ages. Your current elites are not your great-grandfather's elites. There is no intellectual equivalence between the likes of what we see today and the Nathan Rothschilds and the Astors and the people who were running the show 100 years ago or so. And so, yeah, I have great hope that that this time there is a failure. And it's I believe that the whole concept of usury banking, central banking, is going to be exposed for the source of the world's miseries once and for all. And I'll honestly say, I think the concept of cryptocurrency gives that power to people who want to go that way. We no longer need central banks. They don't have the control if cryptocurrencies are available to the greater majority of us.
Well, that's quite a bit to cover there. I think about
the personal opinion.
Yeah, no, it's quite a bit to cover. But as far as the language that we've heard, you know, the Great Reset, that's for there's kind of two sides to that coin, you know, and some might say there's three sides to a coin. In this case, we've got, you know, people benefiting massively. I mean, there's been such a massive consolidation of power and money from this. And then on the other side of it, you have the people that at a base level or have suffered through it and have had a lot of loss, you know. And so, you know, the expense of it cannot really necessarily be quantified at this point. But moving forward from this, there's always kind of been a sense of out of thin air, or a sense of magic to it, or a sense of understanding, you know, greater things and kind of pulling the wool over the eyes. I'd like to kind of get into some of the origins of that as far as money magic goes, if that makes sense.
Sure. Well, what I would frame the whole thing in the context of this, which is familiar to most people who've done a serious study, particularly of Old Testament laws and even ancient laws and so on, that this concept of the Great Reset, which we know is not really a reset for the benefit of the populations of people, it's there to keep the old system going, but in a different form, is what they mean. But it's part of this weird thing that what I call satanic influences, which simply means adversarial to righteous systems that were instituted in the Golden Age, which becomes synonymous with the revealed word by God. But in the Bible and in many of the old ancient traditions that I relate to, what I call the Silver Age of the priesthood, there's this concept called Jubilee, all right? And Jubilee is this complete repudiation of all debt, and in the biblical sense, it's every 49 years, all right? And you just get a reset of debt. And this was always designed to ensure that you didn't get land speculation taking place within the economy. The idea being that the land that we live on is owned by God by right of creation. We didn't create it and such. And if you don't have a system of jubilee or reset every period or so, and such, then you get speculation on the land in terms of price until it becomes accumulated, and only those people who have the money to take part in it. A Jubilee system stops land speculation dead in its tracks. And the Persians did this every time a new king came on. They declared a complete Jubilee of all debts. I think we're, in a weird way, we're going through a Jubilee. And because I am a Christian, I believe that there is a there is the influence of the higher power, that is God, behind this, that that we are in a very special period in history where this is about to take place. And but those who would oppose this would, of course, try to recast the whole concept of Jubilee as simply them resetting a financial system back to the one that they've always been using. But I think we're at that stage, particularly because of the arrival of cryptocurrency, where people are just going to say, we don't need the central banking stuff. This idea of a private group of people being able to issue money and then make claims on everything we produce because we can't pay their interest, that doesn't exist. People are going to wake up to that. That's going to be a great awakening when people understand there is a better way to run money, to use money. There's a correct way for money to be used as a measure rather than the central banking method.
I think one of the biggest myth shatterings that I've seen surrounding that is the cost that it takes to actually run a bank versus to mine Bitcoin. I don't know if you've seen that chart, but it's like, that's one of the biggest poo-poos out there, is like, oh, it takes so much energy to mine Bitcoin, it's not sustainable, da-da-da-da. And then you look at how much it costs to actually run a banking system, and it's so much more.
They produce, and,
it's so much more.
You know.
Yeah, and you've got totally different backing happening, complete decentralization and the security surrounding it. And I have heard a rumor that, quote unquote, the deep state and negative powers that be have a major play in cryptocurrency, that they at least are leveraging it because they can't quite mimic it yet. They've been trying to kind of delve in and get their hands on it. But what's kind of what do you see from that angle?
I see failure on their part. The decentralized cryptocurrencies absolutely guarantees nobody's going to go to war on a national basis over financial issues if a system like that is operating throughout the world. Unlike the ability of central banks to manipulate conflicts, as they have done, particularly the First World War and Second World Wars were absolute case studies in how central banks manipulated the situation to bring nations into conflict, while banks in those nations in conflict with each other continue to do business with each other and such. So, James, it comes down to this whole idea of this need to control, all right? And if you are of a mindset that says there is a scarcity of resources on the planet, all right, and where there's a scarcity, there's the potential that you can die because you have lack of access to those resources. So therefore, I want to control all access to all resources. That's ultimately the fundamental goal of what a central bank is about. They believe in the scarcity of resource on the planet, and they believe that they are the ones who are the aristocracy of purpose, as Daniel Estulin calls it, when it comes to utilizing those resources. And so therefore, they should have total control over those resources. And the best means, the finest means to doing that is a interest-based financial system. Once that goes away, they don't have any of that control left. It literally disintegrates in terms of their ability to manipulate us to kill each other in what I believe is one of the greatest crimes that the Satan Death Cult culture has brought about, which is, you know, global conflicts or just wars, you know, your run-of-the-mill wars. People get killed because people are constantly trying to, you know, monopolize access to resources in a way where they don't actually do the work in exploiting those resources. Do you know what I mean? You know,
yes.
The farmer should benefit from what he goes out and farms. You know, the miner should benefit from what he goes and digs out, he or she goes out and digs out of the ground and so on. But that's not what the central banking system does. It puts the power in the hands of the financiers. And it's all because we're scrapping over this non-existent interest stuff to pay back our loans. And, you know, some of us are always going to come up short.
So they're good at diversifying their assets, but not totally at diversifying how they subjugate and control.
Yeah, I just think their time is done now. I think in a funny way, technology has actually caught up with them. They've always been about, you know, I mean, this, you know, technological innovation is one of those resources, those scarce resources that they like to control. Very few of these people who are in the control business are actually the inventors and so on of what powers our technological breakthroughs, our economy in that way and such. But that's something that they've always wanted to control as well. And cryptocurrency is it truly is a phenomenal concept in that, really the only control that anybody would have over cryptocurrency would be to shut down the internet. All right. So who has the kill switch for the internet? Would they do that? But it's a little bit like the conundrum. You know, if I want to cull the population and bring it down to 500 million Georgia Guidestone style or something like that, how do I do it? Do I do it through war? Do I do it through disease? Do I do it through famine? Whatever. If I do it through disease, I could end up killing myself by releasing a disease that kills humans and so on. There's always been that conundrum. It's the same thing with shutting down the internet. They'll kill themselves. Now, they might want to do that, but they've got so much invested in this idea that they are owed a new golden age that they rule over. And this is when you get into the actual esoteric foundations of what some of these people who have, remember that central banking is simply a tool in the hands of people who have these occult concepts of a golden age in which they are to be the main inheritors.
I'd like to actually dive a little bit deeper on that. Kind of who are they? How do they function? And why is that driving them? As far as, I mean, you touched on it a little bit earlier about them being kind of inbred, kind of where are their origins? I know you talked about kind of a different class. I think last time we talked about Cain and who did he marry and does that have a tie in here? Is that a very long arc? Am I reaching there or is that, the connection point?
No, not at all. It's intricately connected because, you know, this is what we kind of discussed outside the interview, you know, this darker side of, you know, what I call the Satan Death Cult, you know, concept. And, you know, if you read my book, Satan Death Cult, you know, you may end up following lines of investigation that look into the existence of and practice of ritual rape, murder, even cannibalism, you know, simply because these are attributes that are associated with the god Saturn, the god and the sun Jupiter, or Cronus and Zeus, as they're called in Greek mythology. You know, in the historical sense, ritual murder and cannibalism are a fact. It's also a fact that it exists in the contemporary sense. It goes on in the world today, and in areas that people are totally unaware of. But the question is, why would people do this, and how did it all get started? This is where we go back to Cain, and particularly a character called Nimrod. And you know, I prefer this discussion is if they're trying to give the worldwide thing, because it just gives one aspect about how one group of humans have gone down this way. Other groups of humans did exactly the same thing. The Mayans, Mesoamericans had the same problems where they adopted murderous practices. The Chinese did, and so on. And everybody's gone through this phase in all the different cultures. But, you know, in terms of the culture, that what you might call, Eurocentric Western culture, it's the key question for anyone following this line of inquiry, in hoping to make sense of what they will discover, is to ask where did it all get started. So, in thinking about that, during our last chat, we touched upon the idea that, you know, many Christian churches teach that the Bible tells us about fallen angels and how they impregnated human women to produce a race of giants that terrorized the earth. So this is actually a very good place to start with how some of this stuff gets into the culture that we have, because it's there in what you would call the Christian ideology. It's also there in the esoteric and the cult thing. So, you know, the concept of actual miscegenation between humans and spiritual demonic entities, you know, is something that the ancient Hellenistic religions are full of. This is directly related to Babylonian concepts of Saturn worship. So it was this idea of angel-human miscegenation is part of, you know, this overall Hellenistic pagan influence that was being blended as much of the early Christian churches, much to the consternation of the Apostle Paul. And, you know, unfortunately, the idea of fallen angels having, you know, giant babies with human women has also become a foundation, which I would say is a rotten foundation upon which a great deal of Christian popular theology and eschatology and prophecy is based. However, here's the good news and the bad news. It's this, that the elite dark occultists and various Saturn worshippers, whatever you might want to call them, have also made this crucial mistake in believing that, you know, divine entities, angels, have copulated with human women to produce giants or titans. And the only difference between the modern Christian concept that most Christians would hold to of this, you know, interpretation and that of the Saturn worshippers is that the Saturn crowd, they love the idea. They want in on it. And they have been trying to forge these kinds of unions with these perceived spiritual entities for at least the last 2,500 years. This is the reason for all the sex magic orgies, the rituals associated with the lower end of occult practitioners. And occasionally, you know, they murder somebody in the act. So their shared mistaken belief with Christianity, that fallen angels or the so-called, like, you know, the watchers of Genesis chapter 6. I think in our last interview I said Genesis chapter 8, but it was chapter 6. This concept went down with the fallen angels idea. This idea that they are said to have, you know, cohabited with human women to produce giants, this is central to why the biblical character Nimrod is considered so important in occult and Saturnian worship circles, since he is supposedly one of these giants, one of these hybrid species that went on to sort of bully themselves on the earth and throw their weight around. And so nowadays, everyone who gets into the various variations of Saturnian worship, whether it's the pretty pathetic Thelemite type stuff to Masonic ritual to whatever you can identify these Saturnian influences in. Everyone who is involved in that, they want to be a Nimrod, all right? And what I mean by that is they want to be reincarnated into the family bloodlines that he is said to have spawned. Family bloodlines that are believed to be a superior hybrid species infused with the blood of demonic spiritual entities tied directly to the god Saturn himself. So that's the essence of the sex magic rituals, the human sacrifice, are really attempts to influence and enjoin Saturn-related entities into becoming part of your reincarnated future. These guys have a reincarnated rather than a resurrected vision of the future. And they want to, at the point of conception, influence it so that their reincarnated journey is joined by these entities, enjoined by these entities to give them that inside what you would call specialness when they become reincarnated. It's so adverse to the biblical concept of resurrection it almost beggars belief how they came up with it. But that is essentially it. They have a reincarnation basis to a lot of their thinking, and their whole drive is to effectively make sure that at the point of conception, when they are reincarnated, that they're getting some of this angel blood, this fallen angel blood, this Nephilim type existence. And that, unfortunately, is why you get such extreme ritualistic sacrifices that involve killing, rapes of babies, all these sorts of things. It's all designed to get the attention of these entities to become a part of the conception process of the person in the future. I dare bring it up, abortion. It's very interesting when people believe, there's that argument, when is a human? Is it at birth or is it at conception? The Christian believes it's at conception. Funny enough, the Saturn worshippers are all for abortion, also believe life begins at conception. Whether people like it or not, abortion is very much in line with that whole passing of the firstborn through the fires of Moloch, pure Saturn worship. And a lot of that creates the energy for these people to then ensure in whatever ritualistic way that Saturn entities are present at their own reconception when they are reincarnated.
So you bring up Moloch and the belly of the beast symbology there. Can you expand on that a little bit and how that ties to the Saturnian sky? I believe there's a strong connection there.
Yes. Let's look at some of what Saturn is about, okay? A thumbnail sketch of what Saturn is he is somebody who, he's a god who castrates himself, who proceeds to try and eat his children, proceeds to engage in all manner of rape and crime, while also being claimed to be the god of law and order, along with his son Zeus. All right, so you've got this dichotomy that takes place in how Saturn is perceived to be this force for good and evil, doing it all at the same time, and it is the aspect of the self-castrating, cannibalizing god that is there in all the major mythologies when it comes to the Saturn archetype that most informs the modern occultist when it comes to these ritualistic crimes, like passing children through the fires of Moloch and so on. Now, the dark side of Saturn worship, it's intricately linked with this, desire to emulate Saturn and thereby imbue oneself with a sense of godliness. And, there's the image of the mythical Saturn. The idea behind much of the dark ritual magic is to become part of the family, as we discussed. People involved in this are never interested in justice. They're purely interested in having influence. And so what they do is they they try to emulate Saturn in the sense that Saturn is royalty in the amongst the gods. Therefore, if you emulate, you are yourself perceived to be a form of royalty. Now, a key aspect of the experience that was observed in, you know, in the mythological record of what was going on with Saturn was that after he castrated himself, he supposedly also disemboweled himself. And then he ate his disembowelment. And then, as I said, he also got involved in cannibalism at a later date. So this concept of a castrated god castrating himself, most people are not going to want to do that to themselves, although there's a strong aspect, particularly in Chinese culture, about the eunuch idea that is fed by that. But this is why acts of castration enter into the ritual aspect when they get victims to be proxies for themselves. And that's what it is. The victims who are brought in to be castrated, to be disemboweled and such, to be used and to be cannibalized and so on like that, they're proxies for what supposedly Saturn himself went through as the great creator god. A lot of these events that were recorded in mythology that I put down to events taking place as planetary catastrophes, these are the events that took place at the beginning of the Golden Age and at the end of the Golden Age. And the self-castration element that was witnessed was when you had the Birkeland current producing the great pillar, the stairway to heaven between the earth and the realm of Saturn, like a bright light. When Saturn was finally and eventually captured by the sun, that Birkeland current was disrupted and it disappeared. It was as if this phallus disappeared from view. And this has been one of the things about the Saturn god archetype. He's always related to the phallic symbolism that you get in a lot of the Moloch and Balamon type religions. And when that happened, at the same time, Saturn exploded, as we discussed, nova style, and it ejected a lot of material as if it was spilling its guts, to use it for want of a better term. And this stuff just ended up circling around Saturn and becoming effectively part of the rings. But for a long time, it was this giant mess that was sort of interpreted as like a snake. You can get that sort of whole feathered serpent thing, Mesoamerican stuff and such. But really, it's this, because of the centrifugal force of the ejection of all this material, what people on Earth witnessed was this giant cloud of debris circling Saturn and almost engulfing Saturn in such a way as it looked like Saturn was battling the chaos monster and such. And this is where you get the connection between snake worship, dragon worship or serpent worship, and bowels, the entrails. And this is one of the reasons that the idea of divination through studying the bowels, the entrails of eviscerated victims becomes such a part of Saturn worship, because it's associated with Saturn spilling his guts. All right, what they saw, on a planetary level, was emulated down on Earth, where it became this idea that if you disemboweled animals, you could read the entrails. Everybody's heard of that as a divination technique, the reading of the entrails. And of course, where it becomes particularly macabre is when those entrails are the entrails of a child in an active attempt to emulate this Saturnian spilling of the guts, battling the chaos monster, and eventually becoming triumphant as the supreme creator god that brought light into the earth. Make sense?
It does, yeah.
So you're talking about brings up some really graphic and some really dark things. Mm-hmm. And especially when it comes to abortion of children, very young babies, fetuses, there's a lot of symbology here that I think it's important to bring up. And I know that some listeners might take exception to that, but you know, we have in a lot of abortion clinics, especially here in the US, I mean, there's furnaces, right? And then there's where the bodies are supposedly burned, and maybe there's some kind of tie in with that. But there's also the selling of baby parts across the world. Yeah. And that gets into a whole other thing. Can you speak to that any?
Yeah. Look, you know, it's plain to see that if you put a rotten foundation under something, you know, the more you build on top of that rotten foundation, an interpretation or whatever, you know, the more unstable a structure is. And this applies as much to logical thinking and theoretical structures, you know, as it does to any physical structure. And of course, the higher up you build something, you know, like that, the more crazy and shaking and swaying at the top until it all comes crashing down and damage is done to anyone or anything that is sheltering or part of that structure. We're lucky in the sense that the bad guy's spiritual structure is, you know, compromised by this rotten foundation of demonic miscegenation with human beings. And that the trouble is that people are getting killed and really hurt by these, you know, these insane absurdities that have been piled on top of this foundation, this, you know, desire to copulate and conceive with supposed, you know, demonic angelic entities, you know, just to secure some sort of privileged position with the god Saturn. But as a result of what mythology recorded and how it's been interpreted, that's where it breaks down. This is why I'm harping on about a rotten foundation. If you consider mythology to be the record of planetary catastrophes that are supposed to be a warning to us that, you know, this kind of natural cataclysm can take place again and so on, but then you're fine. You're not going to make this this absurd interpretation of trying to, you know, see something to emulate in terms of everyday human life. However, if that's lost to you, if you no longer understand that that is the process, then trying to emulate an archetype as dark as the destructive side of Saturn, it leads you into all of these attributes of Saturn, which are associated with cannibalism, with the passing of children through fires. That has to do, you know, that's definitely there in Saturnian mythologies, and makes its way into Balamon worship or Baal worship or Moloch worship as we know it. And you end up, you know, creating a culture that is based around these interpretations, which people actually believe in. I would say that the ancients have only one thing going for them, and that is that they actually believe this stuff. The ones who got involved in passing the children through the fires, they actually believed it would give them some kind of inside knowledge into how the universe and the mind of God worked, and influence with that being. The shocking thing today is that where this is practiced, there is direct evidence that not only are they practicing these rituals, but it is also then being further exploited for profit as a form of entertainment. And this is something that is, you know, truly stomach-churning, you know, in what we have in the world today, where our media technology allows us, you know, to not only engage in these things, but to record it and then make a profit out of this, these kinds of practices. And that does actually go on. It's the only inside information I can ever claim that I do know, that snuff pornography depicting ritualistic killings is definitely a real thing. And I know that from a New Zealand customs officer that I knew personally, where it was actually the Americans complaining to the New Zealand government, you know, what the hell is this stuff doing coming in here? And it depicted a young child being debauched and murdered in a South Pacific ritual. And, you know, it was then being passed on in the form of video as something to sell and be entertained by. Serial killers, there's a growing market for what they've done, where, you know, before it started with cassette tapes, audio stuff, now a lot of serial killing stuff. We had a guy called Fred West. There's probably a lot of his stuff that was filmed that's on the black market and is used as a form of entertainment. You know, I don't know, does that sort of help answer some of the questions?
Yeah,
because
yeah.
I think that, you know, there are lines of investigations that I would thoroughly recommend people to pursue if they wanted to go down this area, which they could, you know, look into themselves and find the evidence for themselves that we could discuss.
Yeah, and, you know, here in the U.S., I think in episode one, I think you dropped in our first part of this interview anyway, you talked about Pizzagate, and that's, you know, a controversial piece of information here in the U.S. about exactly what you're talking about. And it's, yeah, it's a very dark, very concerning spiritually and physically, right? I mean, this is something that really strikes a lot of ill feelings towards these people and what they're doing to children. And the fact that they believe, like you say, they literally believe what they're doing is going to draw them closer to the mind of God or whatever else is going to happen. And it's a very, very dark thing that humans are doing. And unfortunately, it's something that there's enough evidence out there that we know that there's a global contingent here that's working on what we're talking about.
Yeah, the least of it is it provides great blackmailing material, but that's irrelevant if somebody really wants to do the stuff to get ahead in these sort of the, you know, insane ideas. So, I mean, the natural thing for the average person is to say, you know, do people really do this kind of stuff? You know, what's the evidence for this? What, you know, does it take place? And, you know, I know that when I first got into the film industry, you know, we'd heard about snuff pornography. We'd heard about issues like that. And I'd always wondered if it was true. I spent most of my life thinking it was an urban myth until somebody put me right on that. I've never seen any of it myself or anything. I'm not interested in taking my researches that far. But, yes, it does exist. And, you know, I would suggest to people that any, you know, subsequent investigations, they want to go along these lines to get a handle on whether this stuff actually exists, all right, I would suggest the following path. And I would say that a good place to start is to look at the crimes of Charles de Ray. He's a late medieval French noble. He was the main patron of Joan of Arc. He was a man who may have murdered as many as 300 children in brutal sex murder rituals, possibly designed to somehow restore his lost wealth. He was involved in disemboweling children, sitting in their guts while naked and trying to divine the future. This is pure Saturnian warped stuff that he was involved in. And once you've looked into the crimes of Charles de Ray and you understand that even in the Middle Ages, this is the late Middle Ages, the early mid-1400s, then consider something that I do cover a lot in my book, Satan Death Cult. You know, go in and look at the evidence for direct ritualistic murderous Satan Baal Amon worship that has been displayed in the what's called the Solar Busker Tarrakey. It's a uniquely Satan-focused kind of tarot deck that was created a few years after Charles de Ray and his murderous exploits. And it was this deck was of cards was specifically created for the influential Vesti family of the Italian Renaissance, just so they could engage in attack magic against their rivals. And Peter Mark Adams does a fantastic, even though expensive, but so recommended book for people who want to get their head around this, called The Game of Saturn, where it shows that even in Renaissance times, when the church was all powerful, the Catholic Church and so on, high elite families were involved in direct concepts of Saturn worship that had absolutely nothing to do with the Christian concepts of judgment and the devil and Satan and so on. And this is a what you will learn from this is that the problem between Satanists and Christians boils down to the idea that there is a conflict between good and evil that is settled by a thing we call Judgment Day. And that's the basic Christian idea, that we live a life and we're resurrected into an eternal life, whatever the Christian denomination version of that is. But we also undergo a type of judgment where a righteous God puts us right and restores us to, being in harmony with his idea of how the universe should be. Under Saturn worship, there is none of this. It is all about the capriciousness of Saturn and how to influence that capriciousness so that it doesn't impact you badly or adversely. It's a bit like, and I have personal experience of this, it's a bit like being in the presence of a particularly nasty gangster, hard man type. You know, there's unpredictable type of people that you don't know which way they're going to go. And you fear their violence and so on, but what you fear is getting on the wrong side of them, inadvertently. And so, you spend all your time trying to avoid that moment where his unpredictability will turn against you and you become the victim of some kind of violence. Well, that's Saturn worship to a T. This is what these people are engaged in. Their God is that type of God. He's capricious, and they're sitting there worried about how they're going to make sure they're not the next victim and in some way benefit themselves, benefit themselves in the future by placating him and using rituals and so on. Once you satisfied yourself that near-modern elites like the D'Este family, Charles de Ray, were engaged in various types of Saturn-focused murder rituals, then consider that today, and any cursory search on Google will show this up, that we have a revival of exactly these types of rituals in the modern world in places like India. I'm talking about these murder rituals, these human sacrifices, and so on. We have them going on in India. It's become almost It's become almost a pandemic in Uganda, an epidemic in Uganda. We've seen it in London. We've seen it in Mexico, to name but a few places. All places where many of these murders are now being classified as examples of human sacrifice. And many of them are performed purely for the financial gain of the participants, the love of money and all that sort of thing. They're trying to influence the creative power that is behind wealth, behind behind everything they think that happens in this world, to make sure that they do well at the expense of, sacrificial victim. And once you've established that sort of thing goes on in the world and have found the evidence in the various newspaper articles, now I would suggest that you'd also add the increasingly obvious evidence that much of the serial killing epidemic that exploded, from the late 1960s to the early 2000s, particularly in the United States, that much of that was organized with links to the pharmaceutical industry, to mind control programs like MKUltra, to Monarch, these kinds of things, and not just the random acts of unconnected madmen. It was done, I believe, all to scare people into accepting the encroachment of a police state, police state-like reforms. And once you accept that idea, and I would recommend the writings of Dave McGowan. He's deceased now, but his books, Programmed to Kill, particularly that book, and strange things in going on in Laurel Canyon, which is a look at what was going on in 1960s Los Angeles in the Laurel Canyon area. These will, I think, convince you that, you know, the idea of serial killing just being random acts of madmen who've gone way over the top and lost it is a myth. And that a lot of these killings are, in fact, a form of organized killing. And I would go so far as to say that the cat was nearly let out the bag in terms of the Tate LaBianca killings, the Charles Manson killings. There's an example of organized serial killing. And ever since then, they've always problematized this idea of a lone individual, a lone man, madman. But once you've established that, what you have the case is the likelihood that there has been a program of ritual slaughter, perpetrated on the greater population, you know, for the benefit of the state corporate elite. And that has in recent years shifted from serial killing to terrorism, which is now in the process shifting into a hyperversion of Charles Manson's, you know, call for race war, particularly in the United States. That's kind of where that's heading. But ultimately, if you take these lines of research, you're going to end up facing probably the most disturbing evidence of Satan death cult culture influence in the modern world. And that is the absolute explosion in internationally trafficked children and women and the disappearance of many victims on a scale that can only point to, it can only point to a, like an industrial level of organization. Nobody in the media cares about this. And, how do we know they don't? Because when you've got the likes of here in Britain, you've probably heard of Jimmy Savile, you've Harvey Weinstein, who's a very mild example of this. You are actually looking at strong evidence of the continuing widespread procurement programs aimed at furnishing the elites who are much higher up the food chain with their human victims. I would say that a close study, which is going back to Dave McGowan and his whole concept of organized serial murder, is that, you know, serial killers like John Wayne Gacy, Marc Dutroux, the guy from Belgium, the idiot Henry Lee Lucas, who confessed to 3,000 killings, but, you know, probably killed 15 or so people anyway. They seem to have confirmed this uncomfortable fact that they were procuring in some way for people higher up the chain. Some of the most famous gangsters, like the Cray twins here in London back in the 60s, Lucky Luciano, New York, they were primarily involved in this kind of trade, rather than the sort of the glamorous gangster, you know, stuff of, you know, sort of gangs fighting gangs for control of turf and so on. These guys were some of the worst procurers of, child prostitutes and what was known back in the day as white slavery, but as basically sex slavery of women and children. And slowly, you know, you start to tie it all in that, you know, Hollywood has been one giant procurement operation almost from the get-go in terms of facilitating this trade to feed these higher ups people with a steady, steady lineup of victims. But what you will find is that it all actually gets worse. And for me, this is the most horrifying aspect of what is going on in the world today, because at the root of all this is what is now this increasingly brazen attempt to normalize what is possibly the last Saturnian taboo nobody you would think would ever fall for. And that is to, in the sense of being able to be openly practiced. And that is mass public cannibalism, you know, the Soylent Green thing. The promotion of cannibalism as an acceptable human practice is something, it takes us full circle directly back to the fundamental practices surrounding the god Saturn and how certain people perceive their relationship to him. You know, virtually every pantheon of gods and mythology alludes to cannibalism in some form or another. And, you know, once all the various perversions, you know, from bestiality to ritual murder, pedophile rape, and pedophile murder, all this sort of stuff is almost becomes blasé, it is the act of moving into cannibalism that I believe that they want the human population to ultimately steer itself towards.
So that's a lot to digest. And for our listeners, you know, it's not unfounded what Troy has gone on about here. And part of what at the end of the day that I think about is the intent behind what's happening. And from a Christian perspective, there's kind of this like, you know, the opposition in things that's so interesting to me and very striking. And, you know, that whole intent of like, I want to be a proxy, gain these attributes of, from my God, you know, but to do it, the means by which doing, you know, through which you do it is completely, you know, in exact opposition to things that we would call sacred. So that's very interesting to see that kind of played out. And I think looking forward that there is some intention when it comes to, you know, bringing back something along the lines of an antichrist or something, you know, I guess that the whole urge, demiurge mentality that maybe a Saturnian or a cultist would hold, you know, that intention might be leading there.
Yeah. Well, you know, what I was thinking while you were saying that, James, was that, you know, there's that question of, you know, what does it mean to be satanic, which is very highlighted by the fact that Christ actually called Peter Satan at one point during his betrayal. Peter tried to actually step in and rescue Christ. And for his troubles, Christ rebuked him by saying, "Get behind me, Satan." Now, most Christians believe that at that moment, Satan possessed, an entity called Satan possessed Peter to try and do that sort of stuff. But you've got a problem with that because why would Satan try to stop the planned murder of Christ by possessing Peter, you know, at that moment when in fact we know that the forces of Satan were already arrayed against Christ to bring about his demise. In terms of the trial that he would face and so on like that. Now, the fact is that he still calls Peter Satan, and that's simply because Satan is not a proper noun. It means to be adversarial. It means to be against God. And when you think of God as the Word who became flesh in the form of Christ, but that in the beginning was the Word. God is a spirit, but in the beginning was the Word, and the Word is effectively saying it's a communication of an idea from a supreme creator to creation. And when you have that concept that it is the spiritual forces of the Word that defines God, particularly in Old Testament times, and defines the life of Christ, he becomes the embodiment of that Word, then Satanism becomes anything that opposes that Word, anything, all right? And my understanding is that the Bible is far more interested, rather than a single entity, the Bible is far more concerned with the systems that get put in place to lead men into an adversarial relationship with God. And the absolute pinnacle of these systems is what was set up on the plains of Shinar, the plains of Jura, in the form of Babylon, which would be the system that would influence a whole succession of nations down to the present age, that I identify ultimately as Mystery Babylon, with its central banking and so on like that. Now, for people who, become very downhearted when they read the interpretations of like the 13th chapter of Revelation about the beast and the Antichrist and the conflation of all these words into one, you know, diabolical individual, what I would point out is that the Babylonian system, that which means confusion, that's the Hebrew word that is used to define Babylon. The Babylonian system is really first instituted when Nebuchadnezzar's government sets up a golden statue in the plains of Dura and demand that everybody bows down to that golden statue. And people have had all kinds of interpretations. We know the story of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego and how they rejected that kind of worship of that, and they were subsequently put into the fire because Nebuchadnezzar decreed everybody had to worship the statue. What I want to point out to people is that we're given the dimensions in Daniel chapter 3 of the statue. And the statue, which we are told is a statue of a man made of gold, the cubits that are given as measurement for that statue all add up to a very significant number. That number is 666. So when you read, you know, the mark of the beast, or what I like to prefer to say, the bounty of the beast, when you read about the mark of the beast and, you know, there's a number and it is a number of man and his number is 666, this is not the first time in scripture that this particular number has come up. And in that sense, that's your double witness that biblical law, you know, demands of any kind of biblical interpretation on the theological level, that 666 is identified with the system put in place by the Babylonian system that was satanic or adversarial to God and his economic system. And that 666 system, they call it the mark of the beast because Daniel tells us very clearly that beasts are nations. And so the mark of that beast is a man-made system that will govern various nations down through time that will be adversarial to God. And its mechanism for being adversarial to God is that it places a mark, a bounty on you, where you either are able to live by the strength of work with your forearm, which is manual labor, or by intellectual labor, which is your forehead, represented by your forehead. And so therefore, I would argue to people that the 666 system, the adversarial satanic system that we have, stems from Babylon, and it is simply that financial system that you cannot buy or sell unless you buy into central banking, unless you are part of it. And you can only become part of it if you sell your manual labor or your intellectual labor to get the money it issues and so on. Okay. So, you know, to me, this is the essence of, you know, what it is to be satanic. And that's one of the main reasons why, it's not important to me if Satan is an entity or an egregore, which is my personal preferred choice, in terms of his existence and such. What's important is the idea that has been introduced that is adversarial to God, satanic, which leads to the root of all evil being the love of money. It couldn't be more simple than that. The root of all evil is not the love of Saturn. It's not the love of Satan, according to scripture. It is the love of money. And that system is, in my opinion, it is the definition of satanic.
Wow. So we've gone kind of full circle on that definition, but also like encapsulated so much. We can't thank you enough for coming back on. I think we could certainly talk for probably another 6 hours, you know, if we had the faculty and energies to do so. But this has been a fantastic summation of some of your work, and I think it's something that our listeners need to be kind of listening to, watching for, and applying to their lens of knowledge. So we appreciate you coming back on. We appreciate and respect your time. We've got another guest coming up, so we've actually got it. We've got a bail, but probably that's BAIL. But we'll be in touch. We'll be in touch with you. We'll let you know when your episodes. We're looking to kind of stack those one against the other, so they'll get the Michael Armstrong kind of like what is the electric universe, and then we'll get our last episode and then how that ties in. And I think you did such a good job tying in our last discussion that it bridges it quite well for our listeners. So that's been fantastic.
Well, the pleasure's all been mine. Thank you very much for having me on. I hope I wasn't too convoluted at times. Very, very broad subject in many respects, but honestly, thank you so much for providing a platform for this kind of discussion.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Lost River Legends. If you enjoyed this episode and you would like to help support the podcast, please share it with others and consider subscribing. Here at Lost River Legends, our primary focus is delivering unique topics, amazing guests, all paired with top-notch production value. The Earth we live on has many hidden secrets, countless paranormal stories, and is filled with amazing, curious humans who are trying to find answers to life's questions. Here at Lost River Legends, we are no different. We believe an active curiosity to the unknown is ingrained in the human experience. We hope you'll join us on our journey to explore the lost legends of the Earth by listening to past and future episodes. Until then, James and I wish you health, happiness, and a curious mind. And remember, the clock of life is ticking away. Don't waste another moment and live your best life.